Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Brought to you, of course, by globalresearch.ca. And the two go together. The website for the kind of information that you get on air on this program with very distinguished guests like my guest today. And on the website, the material, the articles that these individuals write contribute to the website. And my editor, Michelle Chosudowski, who's traveling, he'll be back to host before too long. Not quite certain where he is. He's been in Asia, but he may be, I think he's been on the move. He's been away for a little bit, but he'll be back possibly by the end of this week. My guest today is Rachel Rudolph. Rachel is a professor of Middle East and Islamic studies. She teaches at Emory and Henry College. And her research and her writing focus mainly on resistance strategies, especially Islamic movements in Algeria, in Palestine, and the Philippines. And she's written several books. One is From Terrorism to Politics. Another is Saudi Arabia's War on Terrorism. And she's working on a new book now on the war on Gaza, about as timely a subject as I can imagine. Rachel, welcome to the program. I'm delighted to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
So much happening, and it doesn't seem to get any better, Rachel. Of course, we know the war on Gaza raged from December 27th to January 17, 18, officially. Israel supposedly called a ceasefire, but Israel never ceases fire. It simply pauses. And the killing and the attacks go on daily. The borders of Gaza stay closed. The siege continues. The misery continues. It's an endless struggle with no end. It keeps going, and the people of Gaza are isolated with really no one but their own resilience to keep them going. Rachel?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. That's absolutely.
Your comments.
It's absolutely correct. I mean, there, since the supposed ceasefire, I mean, there's been continuous attacks from Israel on a daily basis. And let alone, it seems like the world, well, we have focused somewhat on more on Gaza, but there are still continuous attacks that are ongoing in the West Bank. Just the other day, Israel had ceased there was about 123 acres of Efrat for new settlements to build, which complicates matters tremendously.
And they keep seizing land, absolutely, attacks, oppression, land seizures, arrests, you name it. This goes on every single day in the West Bank. And I follow headlines online about it, Rachel. And, I mean, there's no end to this in sight. And, of course, none of this gets reported in the U.S. in the major media. But the people there are absolutely isolated. They're separated from – communities are separated from each other. And the West Bank is under military occupation. Of course, Gaza really is, too. Israel never left Gaza. It merely redeployed its troops. Well, I hear some interference. That music also means, Rachel –
yes.
That we have a commercial break coming up. We have a few of those.
Okay. This is new to me with doing it in this format.
It'll be very smooth. We have a few breaks, but we have lots of time to discuss this. So let's take the break, and we'll come right back.
Okay.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Rachel Rudolph. Rachel, let me read one headline that's so typical of what goes on in the West Bank, because people forget about it. They simply have no idea what's happening. But one website I check several daily on what's happening in the region, one is the International Middle East Media Center, and this came from yesterday. And the headline is, the Israeli military the West Bank is under military occupation, so there are troops all over the place.
Right, right.
The Israeli military kidnaps 26 Palestinian civilians from the West Bank. These are civilians. They did nothing. Their homes are invaded. They mentioned the cities of Tulkarm, Jenin, Qaqilia, Ramallah, Bethlehem, and Hebron. They simply roam at will. They break into homes. They can do it any hour of the day and night. They seize young men, older men, anybody they want. They haul them away. I've written that, like America, torture in Israel is official policy. It is absolutely shocking. You can haul out the documents. You can read direct quotes from Israeli officials. And when I write this stuff, I sure don't make it up. I go to sources, and I love it when the offenders are the ones who provide me the best sources. And they certainly do, both in Israel and in the U.S. And it's astonishing to find this stuff and quote it. So these I think mostly young men, they're hauled away. They're taken to some detention center or prison, and they're really brutalized when they get there. And what do? They're simply Palestinians living their lives, and they can be seized on any pretext or no pretext. Well, Rachel, I know you write about this all the time.
I was also going to share, when I was, summer of 2007, I was in the West Bank doing not only research but also engaging in humanitarian activities. And I stayed in different parts, but for the most of my part in Bethlehem. And in if you remember, in 2007, Israel had released, I think it was around 400 prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
With their arrangement with Abbas during that time period. But right after the release of those prisoners, you'd have a couple invasions in Bethlehem, where the Israeli military would come in the evening. Remember, when you stayed in Nablus, there was armed activities, a fight between the Israelis and who were entered in, I think it was around between 11 and 12 p.m. The next day the checkpoint was closed, so we couldn't get through because of the Israel claim that suspected militants were still on the run. It continues. It goes on a daily basis. I had interviewed several individuals who had been detained in Israeli prisons and jails, and the torture was just unbelievable. The stories were horrific of what they experienced.
Oh, I've written about it, detailing exactly what is done to these people. And again, it's really shocking for people to read this. And it begins the moment they're taking, the soldiers pretty much rough them up en route to a detention center. There may be a stopping-off point before they haul them off to some prison. They're out of touch. They have no rights. It's very hard for families sometimes even to find out where their loved ones are. And what do these people do? I mean, they really did nothing whatsoever. And, of course, no matter what anybody would do, international law is unambiguous. Torture is illegal against anyone, anywhere, anytime, for any reason, and there is never an exception, never, under any conditions. But Israel ignores it, the U.S. ignores it, and it's pretty outrageous, Rachel. Even when they make a big headline out of releasing prisoners, it's usually ones who are getting close to their release date anyway.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they just round up more. So they can release 200, 400, whatever, and then within weeks they've seized an even greater number. But that never makes headlines.
No. And some of the individuals that are released, things that aren't mentioned in the media is the fact that it's not like they can go back to a regular life, because if they're an individual who's part of one of the movements, regardless of whether it's Al-Aqsa or Hamas or Fatah, and they've been released, they're still not cleared because you don't know whether assassination orders have been released and whether their life is still in danger.
That's another issue, too. Assassinations are also official Israeli policy.
Yes.
It's and not just inside Israel or the territories, anywhere in the world. Israel just arrogates to itself the right to rob the world as it pleases and kill anybody they want. And they're very sophisticated. I mean, they don't go around shooting people in the streets. I think it's been documented, Rachel, if not conclusively, close enough to satisfy me, that Israel killed Yasser Arafat. How they managed to do it, I'm not sure. But the people close to him, including his own physician for many years, believes that he was poisoned. And they disposed of the body so quickly that they took him to a hospital in Paris. And then when he was awfully ill, and when he passed away, there was no autopsy. They just kind of hauled him away and got him in the ground before anybody could look into exactly what might have killed him. I don't have any doubt in the world that Israel murdered Yasser Arafat. Why? Because they couldn't cut a deal with him anymore. And Israel doesn't negotiate, as you know, Rachel. Israel demands, and they want compliance. And if they get compliance, they can get along very well with the Palestinians. And if Palestinians want to assert their rights as they have a right to do, that simply is not a basis for negotiation with Israel. So Arafat turned down the last negotiations, the last Camp David. You remember that?
Yeah.
With Clinton, Arafat, and Ehud Barak, now the defense minister. He turned it down because he was offered a deal he could not possibly accept. It was unconditional surrender was what it amounted to. And he knew that he probably would have had his head handed to him by his own people had he ever accepted that. So he didn't, and then he was vilified afterwards. So this goes on and on and on. But from what you've seen there, Rachel, in your own writing, what can you tell my audience, my listeners, that is really important to hear?
In terms of negotiations with all the parties, you cannot exclude Hamas. I mean, it's just Hamas is reality. Hamas is a legitimately elected political party. You have to include them. And whether that's the ceasefire, the negotiations taking place, or whether peace talks are resumed again, Hamas needs to be included.
Oh, there's no question about that. And my belief, and others have said it on this program, that of all the governments in the Middle East, including Israel, no government was more democratically elected than Hamas, but you'd never know it because the U.S. labels them a foreign terrorist organization. Why? Because they're independent and they want to govern their own people, as they have a right to do. They want a democratic election. I don't call Israel a democracy because Israel only allows rights for Jews, nobody else. It would be like America allowing rights only for Christians and nobody else, or maybe only for Christians and Jews and nobody else. And I don't think it's too far removed from that right now, Rachel. We certainly don't treat Muslims very well in this country. It's outrageous, and I've done my share of writing on that, on political prisoners. But Hamas was vilified from the first day, and I think Israel pretty much knew that because Fatah had really failed so badly, that Hamas would win that election back in January 2006, if I got my date right.
Yes, yeah.
They knew they would win, so the strategy was well in place before that election. And it probably really began when the decision was made to get rid of Arafat. And then they did, and then Hamas came in, and the siege began over a year and a half ago, and the siege continues, and the people are slowly being starved to death, denied vital medical care, denied the most basic things people need to survive, and the world community goes along with this, including other Arab states. It's outrageous.
Did you see Israel announced today they were debating in the Israeli cabinet about the current ceasefire, the proposal that was that Egypt had submitted to Israel, and they made the announcement that they were not going to open the borders at all until the Israeli soldier Shalat is released.
Oh, indeed, I did see that. And just imagine the hypocrisy where Israel holds 10, 12, or more thousand Palestinian prisoners, the great majority of them absolutely innocent. They should never be held in an Israeli prison or in detention. And Hamas seized one Israeli soldier. And Israel uses that as a pretext for not wanting to negotiate. Well, if Shalat didn't exist, Rachel, Israel would come up with something else.
Oh, I completely agree.
It's simple to find pretext to avoid doing what you want to do. So you're starving 1.5 million people in Gaza. You're starving them on the pretext of Hamas holding one soldier. I'd love to see a headline in America explaining that.
Yeah, I don't think it would make mainstream media.
Oh, it certainly would not. It will make this program all the time, but not mainstream. We need to take another break.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm on with Rachel Rudolph. We're discussing occupied Palestine, Gaza, and one other issue. Rachel, we've discussed it on this program. Of course, Israel had an election on February 10th. I decided I had to write something about it. And Israel really more and more is shifting to the right and an extremely harsh rule. I came up with a very harsh title. I called the article Fascist Rule in Israel. The parties are so extreme to the right that even the Labor Party is supposedly centrist, but they're a neoliberal party, they're militant, and if you include Labor in my count, the parties from Labor characterized the way I just did to the hard right parties, including Kadima, that calls itself less hard right, but my goodness, with its original leader, Ariel Sharon, to me it's about as hard right as you can imagine. And Likud with Bibi Netanyahu, I counted 104 out of 120 Knesset legislative seats won by that bloc. So the more moderate parties and two Arab parties that won a few seats but have no power whatsoever, no matter how many seats they might win, absolutely no power. Israel has really lurched very sharply to the right, and the people of Israel, I don't know what their thinking is. These are the people that they voted for, and I just can't imagine that there's not a higher percentage of people in the country that don't realize that there's no way to get security by governing this way. You absolutely guarantee yourself a lack of security, but Israel is very strongly fought to the right of center, and I see it as just a very dangerous thing, more dangerous than ever. Whoever becomes prime minister, they're so jockeying to try to pick a prime minister because no party ever wins a majority. There are too many of them.
Yeah, they have some reports that were released today mentioned that it's going to take up to a couple weeks before they even decide who will be prime minister, and then they're talking about potentially a power-sharing idea where Livni will have 2 years and Netanyahu another 2 years if the coalition cannot be built at all. But regardless of whether that is the case, I mean, it's problematic for Palestine itself with the way the elections turned out.
Oh, indeed. Tippi Livni, the Kadima candidate, the party of Ariel Sharon, on the one hand, and Likud, that has a long legacy of very ugly prime ministers, warlike, just awful people. Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu, a former prime minister, who spouts the most outrageous stuff, and then you've got this other character, Avigdor Lieberman. Oh my goodness, his party came in third. If Israel has an out and out fascist party, it's the English translation. Israel is our home party, and this is the guy who leads it. And articles, and I mentioned this in my article. Articles are calling him a kingmaker, because one side or the other may have to make a deal with him, and bring him into the government. But there's a report out. And I've got it in my article that it looks like he's going to be charged with money laundering. Did you see that?
No, I did not.
Oh, I've got it in my article. I'm going to get it out this week, probably either tomorrow or Friday. It looks like he'll be charged, but at the same time, the way justice moves along in Israel, it could be many, many, many months before anything ever comes to fruition and charges are brought and there's a trial, if there is one. But, of course, Olmert was charged with corruption. I don't know where that stands now. They certainly haven't hauled him off to jail. But, and Sharon, as I remember, I think was charged with corruption. Or his son, I think, was charged with corruption charges. So, I mean, this stuff goes on, and if you're big and important enough, I guess you can get away with anything.
Yeah. I mean, I'm afraid the damage will already be done.
Well, there'll be a new government, and there'll be a hardline leader, and the Palestinians will continue to suffer, and the world goes along with this. And I see no relief under Obama. I've quoted Obama with his own words on his policy, his attitude toward Israel, and this and the people he surrounded himself with, Rachel, his top security people. You can only describe them as Zionist zealots. That's what they are. And others in secondary spots, even George Mitchell, who's a more moderate guy, but there's no question that he goes over to do whatever he's doing, to side with Israel and to do absolutely nothing for the Palestinians, and citing Northern Ireland as an example of what he accomplished in the past, to me is a very bad example, because occupied Palestine is not Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
They stopped fighting over there, and that's the only way that they came to an agreement. They stopped fighting, but there's not a hint of stopping the fighting in occupied Palestine, and Mitchell isn't even demanding it. So how can there be any negotiation?
Yeah, and Mitchell and the Obama administration is still refusing to talk to one of the main parties, Hamas.
Indeed.
Problematic.
If you don't talk to the one legitimate government, how can you have a negotiation? And you remember Annapolis, Rachel?
Yes.
The one legitimate government was not even invited to the peace talks.
And they're not supposed to be invited to the upcoming Middle East peace conference that's going to be hosted in Russia.
Oh.
But only the participants of the Annapolis conference.
When we come back,
invited.
Explain that, because I'm not current on that. Let's take a break, come back, and then you can explain that conference.
Okay.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. I'm on with Rachel Rudolph. Rachel, I'm not current at all on this conference coming on in Russia, so I eagerly would like to hear something about it, and please explain what that's all about.
Well, the date has not, to my knowledge, the date has not been set yet, but it's supposed to take place sometime within the first part of 2009. Russia's going to host what's been titled a Middle East Peace Conference. Where members of not only the quartet, but all the parties involved at the conference in Annapolis will be present to talk about resuming peace talks between the Palestinians and Israelis. This is problematic. You know, having the conference in and of itself is problematic, first off, not knowing who, by that time we'll know who heads the Israeli government. But there are a lot of issues. If you look at what Mahmoud Abbas recently issued. I mean, he said before we can resume any type of a talk, there must be a halt to settlements, a removal of checkpoints, and Israel must remove the troops back to the pre-September 28, 2000 lines with it in order for there to be any type of dialogue itself.
What about Hamas? Any Hamas representatives that could be invited to Russia?
No, they're not being invited at all. According to the Russian foreign minister, that the meeting will only be, or the conference will only be attended by the countries that took part in the conference in Annapolis.
Oh, dear.
No representatives from Hamas at all.
Now, why would Russia go along with this? Because their stance is at least slightly different than the Western countries.
Yes, I mean, Russia was the first to invite Hamas after it won the elections in 2006. And just the other day, the Russian foreign minister talked with Halim Michel in Damascus regarding the current ceasefire that was being proposed that Egypt submitted to Israel. So I'm not sure where Russia is going by not including them. Whether this is maybe influenced by the other quartet members, in particular the United States, since it's still continuing to refuse to talk to Hamas?
I would guess that if Hamas shows up, then representatives from Washington will not, and probably the rest of the quartet, maybe except for Russia, won't show up either. But again, and we both know this, that there really has never been a peace process. It's all rhetoric, but over six decades, 61 years or so, and counting, and there's never been peace. And that term peace process gets kicked around all the time, and there are lots of supposed plans that are drawn up, the roadmap, and so many. But there's never peace because Israel will only accept peace on one basis, and that's unconditional surrender. But Palestinians have no rights, and of course some in Israel don't even want to settle for that. They really want Palestinians expelled. They want all the choice land for themselves. And I occasionally read more plans that someone or other in the Israeli government may suggest. But they're really just hopeless. I just can't imagine how any legitimate Palestinian leader could accept it. And if they did, sooner or later there'd be a rebellion because they keep enclosing the Palestinians more and more in greatly isolated cantons in the West Bank. And I don't know what they want to do with Gaza. I think the idea for Israel would be to let Egypt take over. But Egypt doesn't want to take over. And on the West Bank, the ideal for Israel would be to expel the Palestinians to Jordan, and Jordan wouldn't go for that. So where do we stand?
No. I mean, the heart of the issue in all the different peace proposals from the beginning that have been put forth, they don't address the heart of the issue. And the heart of the issue is the right of return for many of the Palestinians that were expelled from by Israel back in 1948, plus in the press that continue to be expelled from the territories itself. Think of have you heard about the prisoner exchange negotiations taking place? That Israel said one of its conditions for the prisoner exchange that those that are released, the Palestinian prisoners released, they don't want them to, they want them to be expelled from the West Bank. So they don't want
them to
stay there. Which Egypt has rejected, which thank goodness. But
and expelled to where?
It wasn't mentioned at all as to where they would be expelled to. I'm assuming outside of Gaza or the West Bank itself.
And of course, under Israeli law, any Jew anywhere in the world is welcome to move to Israel and become a citizen, with a few exceptions, like people like myself. I don't think they would welcome me. They probably discovered me by now. I write so often about what they're doing. But most every Jew is welcome to become an automatic citizen of Israel. And the Palestinians, their homeland, they have no right of return. And international law absolutely says that this must be obeyed by a country. Everyone has the right of return, but Israel refuses to obey international law. And one of the bases of admitting Israel to the UN way back after it became a state was that Israel would go along with this, that they would agree to allow the right of return. But they held a secret meeting, as I understand it, a secret cabinet meeting, where even before they agreed publicly to accept this, they absolutely decided that they would not accept it. And the problem is that the international community does not hold their feet to the fire and make them observe international law, so they literally get away with murder and anything else that they want to do. It's a terrible situation.
It is. What's so sad is it's all done in the name of state security. But what about the human factor? What about the people? I mean,
And the security factor, of course, is a non-starter, because the longer you continue policy like this, the less security to have.
Right.
And the best way to have security is to have good relations with your neighbors, not bad ones. How long can people go on like this?
I mean, as long as there's continued oppression and repression of individuals, there's going to be a need for armed resistance.
Oh, absolutely. Your book on the war on Gaza, is that due out shortly, or are you in the midst of writing it?
I'm actually co-authoring it with Saeed Abdel-Wahid in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you know Saeed. He's a professor at Al-Azhar University in Gaza. We're in the process of writing it. We're expecting September 2009 as our release date.
So still a few months away?
Yes.
Oh, well, when you began, you had no idea that that things would come to where they are now. When did you begin writing this? Just recently?
Well, actually, Saeed and I began working on a book on the Hamas-Fatah conflict. And then right before Christmas, it looked as if war was going to break out. And so that was put on hold. and then I started beginning research, because the conditions just didn't feel right. And then sure enough, the war broke out. And so during that time, Saeed and I were corresponding back and forth, and I started compiling the research and putting stuff together for it. And so it's been an ongoing thing since it began.
Well, it's an important topic, Rachel, and certainly for me, absolutely. I mean, this is exactly what I want to focus on. I've had so many programs on this topic with different people, including two Palestinians in Gaza that I was able to get on the program. Actually, three, but one we had a very bad connection. Oh, who did I have on? I'll tell you who I had on. I had on, I don't have his name, Sami Habib.
Okay, yes.
The blogger.
Yes, I know.
And I had on Dr. Musa El Haddad. I had a very good discussion with him. We had a very good connection. And the man who I had on briefly, but we had a very bad connection, so we really didn't have much of a discussion, was Dr. Ayad Sarraish.
Yes.
Do you know them all?
I'm familiar with, I know Sami, but I'm not familiar with the writings of the doctor and the others now.
I had them all on during the conflict, so it was not an easy time, and sometimes you could hear something. I couldn't hear it clearly, but they told me that that was an explosion.
Yeah.
So I heard a small noise, but coming over the phone. I couldn't hear it too clearly, but there was no doubt in my mind that this is going on all the time. And another time I tried to get Dr. Sarraij to come on, and I couldn't contact him, because they told me later that there was an attack that began, and he had a rush to a shelter to get someplace where he thought he might be safe, so I wasn't able to connect with him.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's just terrible. I've seen a few video clips on what went on that would never show up on U.S. TV, with people absolutely suffering terribly, bodies lying around, some of them dead, some of them living, limbs blown off. Just absolutely terrible stuff. And I spent a lot of time on this program, Rachel, discussing it.
It was sort of, I remember the one night I was talking to Saeed, and he said, I have to go. The soldiers have surrounded the apartment building. And then that was it. Then I didn't hear from him for a couple of days. I mean, it was horrible. And being over here, not knowing what's going on the ground and not knowing whether your friends are alive or dead, it was horrific.
He put me on his email distribution list,
yeah.
So I would get his reports. And I remember in one of them he said that his daughter was waiting to go to school, and maybe 50 yards or so away from her, a bomb exploded, and people who were close by were killed by it. And just by the grace of God, she was spared. And, of course, you have to be terrified when something like this goes on. A young girl waiting to get on a bus to go to school. And, of course, everything was completely disrupted. But he might never have seen his daughter again because of that. If the bomb had fallen a little closer to where she was, she'd have been killed.
You know, it's just that, if, you know, we can cite particular instances because we have friends. And we have colleagues that are in Gaza and experiencing this. But, you know, it's everybody. Every Palestinian living in Gaza has experienced this. They've either lost loved ones, they weren't able to, for days, able to find some of their family members. I mean, it's just the human loss is catastrophic.
Oh, it really is. Ramzi Baroud, who runs the Palestine Chronicle website, has been on my program several times. We've gotten to be good friends. And his sister is a doctor in one of the Gaza hospitals. And she told Ramzi, is in constant touch with her. And she told Ramzi, we mentioned this on the program some time back, but she said that there were hundreds of people who were still breathing, but they were clinically dead. They were so badly hurt and so far gone, there really was not much of a chance to save them. So I'm sure there are people dying every day, just adding to the death toll from the war. And the last number I saw different numbers, but one of the ones I saw was around 1,400 killed. And if I remember, I think about 5,000 wounded. And we don't know what the Israeli toll was because they don't report it accurately. I think the numbers were a good deal higher than the official numbers the Israeli military reported. I think I remember...
I think the IDF had reported about 10. But if you look on some of the resistance website news reports, they indicate about... Between 11 and 14.
11 and 14?
Mm-hmm.
I saw one with the number 80 on it.
Really?
I have no idea. I'm sure there were a lot of Israeli soldiers wounded.
Yes. Now, I was talking specifically of death,
well,
in terms of those that have been wounded. I know in terms of Israeli soldiers injured, the number's a lot higher, but in terms of those that were actually killed.
On a couple of Israeli websites, one was Ynet News, and I don't remember, but Haaretz might have reported this too, that there were a good number of Israeli soldiers wounded, and a good number of them very seriously. So who knows whether any of these? I'm certain there were deaths from that. But, again, the reports are very sketchy, so you really don't have any idea what's going on, and the IDF won't say. But there were lots of Hamas resistance fighters, and you take a shot at somebody and you hit them, and they may be alive, they're taken away, and unless there's an official report, you have no idea whether they lived or died. So I'm sure the death toll was higher, but...
One important factor I think we should mention is the fact that, you know, it wasn't just Hamas that was part of the resistance fighting during the Gaza War. I mean, there were other resistance movements, such as Islamic Jihad and the PFLP, that were fighting alongside their brothers in Gaza.
And what's important to understand, and we say this on the program, these people are legitimate resistance. They're not terrorists.
Right.
This is their homeland, and they're defending it, and they're occupied, and they're attacked. And international law is very clear on this. You have a right to self-defense. You have a right to fight back. And to deny that right, for Israel to say, no, they don't have that right, well, of course, Israel is wrong. International law is very clear on this, and I've quoted it several times. But again, you know, resistance is called terrorism. We twist the language. George Orwell would understand this very, very well, Rachel.
Yes, the phrase that one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist is so apt. I mean, the whole designation of something as a terrorist entity or the act of terrorism in and of itself is political.
And some of the same the Mujahideen fighters during the 1980s in Afghanistan against the Soviets. Well, Ronald Reagan invited some of them to come to the White House and call them freedom fighters. The same for the Contras. In Nicaragua, the Contras absolutely were terrorists, but they were invited, and Ronald Reagan referred to them as freedom fighters. So we literally invert things. We call the terrorists freedom fighters, and we call the honorable resistance terrorists. It's a terrible situation. We need to take another break, one more break, Rachel, and we'll come back, and I'll let you finish up. Welcome back. Rachel, let's finish up. You take the last few minutes. We have just a few minutes left. Your thoughts on what's happening and what you see ahead. Please go ahead.
In terms of what I say, as long if we the worst happens and Netanyahu and Lieberman form a coalition and head the Israeli government, there may be another potential conflict and another potential war, and I hope that's not the case. I hope that we can mobilize enough, both domestically in the United States and internationally, as concerned humans, to prevent another atrocity from occurring. You know, as humans, we all have a duty. We all have a moral obligation to support anyone who is being oppressed. But in particular, we have a duty to support our Palestinian brothers and sisters in both Gaza and the West Bank. In terms of the different conditions, you know, we need to remove the conditions that are associated with occupation if we want to reduce violent resistance in and of itself. Nonviolent resistance is not sufficient by itself in order for there to be political success. I mean, you can look at the different historical incidents. Gandhi would not have been successful without armed resistance within India. Martin Luther King would not have been successful without the presence of the Black Panthers. I'm not saying that there's a coordination between violent and nonviolent resistance, but success doesn't happen with just one of them, which is unfortunate. There must also be recognition and negotiations with Hamas and all the political parties. We cannot exclude any of them, and that includes Islamic Jihad, PFLP. Every single political party must be brought into it, and we must push toward a unity government.
Well, absolutely. I can't speak for all of the resistance movements, but Hamas has been very conciliatory. And they're willing to recognize Israel. They're willing to give up 78% of their original country. Their demands are very reasonable. And, of course, Israel will accept no demands, no matter how reasonable. So the conflict persists. And there's no question in my mind, Rachel, that there may be a semi-pause right now. But plans probably, as we speak, are being drawn up for the next conflict. And my concern is it may go way beyond Gaza or the West Bank. that there's a possibility that Israel wants another war with Hezbollah in Lebanon. Iran, absolutely. You hear the most hateful talk about Iran, and if there ever is a conflict with Iran, then the whole Middle East could go up, and it's possible that it could go way beyond the Middle East. It's a very scary situation. Syria as well. And the Obama administration, I don't know where they stand. They're still new. But it's very scary that we could see a greater conflict than we can imagine right now. And there have been articles in Global Research that absolutely suggest a very strong possibility of this. So we watch and wait and hope that none of this happens, but who can know?
Fortunately, we can't know.
Rachel, we're nearly out of time, and I'm very grateful to you for coming on. I hope you'll keep me posted when your book is about to come out, because I absolutely would like to get you back so we can talk about it.
Excellent.
Would you do that?
Sure, I would love to.
Oh, we have each other's email address, and I hope you know how important this topic is for me.
Yes.
And when the book is out, we absolutely have to discuss it on this program.
I'd love to.
Rachel, thank you so much. To my listeners, tomorrow and Friday we'll have archive repeat programs. Please tune in if you missed the ones earlier in the week. And we'll be back Monday with another live program. Till then. And again, Rachel, thank you.
Thank you so much.